Welcome to SCOTUscast, Land Use and Takings Claims Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 25, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Coons v. St. John's River Water Management District. The case raised two questions regarding the power of land use agencies with respect to development permits. First, whether denial of a permit for failure to comply with government conditions constitutes a taking of property under the Fifth Amendment. And second, whether certain nexus and proportionality tests set forth by the Supreme Court apply in such circumstances. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the government's demand for property from a land use permit applicant must satisfy the nexus and proportionality requirement set forth in the court's earlier land use decisions in its Nolan and Dolan cases, even when the situation involves a denial of a permit because the applicant refuses to turn over property rather than the grant of a permit on condition that the property be turned over. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, joined the majority opinion. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. To discuss the case, we have Richard Epstein, professor at New York University School of Law, and Professor Meredith at the University of Chicago Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hi, this is Richard Epstein speaking on behalf of the Federalist Society with respect to a recent decision of the United States Supreme Court in a case called Coons v. the St. John's Water Management District, which deals with a complicated set of questions related to the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions as applied to certain kinds of state decisions with respect to real estate development. The background of the case is typical for cases of this sort. Many years ago, Mr. Coons applied for a permit to develop some 3.7 acres of his land. And in order to get this development underway, he was prepared to surrender a permanent conservation easement over another 11 acres of land that he held at the same particular site. What happened is the water district comes back and says, this is not enough. You have to engage in what it called environmental mitigation. And so we require that you do one of two things. Either you cut down the size of the project from 3.7 to 1 acre, make other expensive adjustments on your own land, and deed the rest of the property over for the conservation easement, or in the alternative, what you do is you fund the certain repairs that are to be made in other parts of the water district dealing with drainage, ditches, and pipes of one sort or another. The value of those particular items was not specified in the opinion. Our friend Coons balked. He brought suit claiming, in effect, that this was unreasonable behavior by the water district. He was turned down by the Florida Supreme Court on the ground that no harm, no foul. That is, since he never accepted a permit to build, he could not claim any particular injury. And the case goes up to the Supreme Court, where the question now is, can he, in fact, get some kind of relief by virtue of the fact that there is an exaction that is imposed upon his real estate development? The first piece of information about this particular case as a doctrinal matter is that the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, which says that you cannot use the permit power to make illicit exactions from private individuals, that is, if they have a right to develop their property in certain ways, you can't say to them that they will only be able to exercise that right if they make some tangible concession to the government, that doctrine seems to be in working order. One of the cases that was cited in this situation was a case called Frost against the California Railway Commission, and that involved the question as to whether or not the state could decide to let carriers on the road only if they were prepared to carry goods from all suppliers, not only from their own. And the decision as it came down was, nope, you can't impose that kind of condition on people, forcing them to go into a business that they don't want to do. That decision had been in somewhat of disrepair in recent years, and to see it cited in the Supreme Court on this occasion indicates that we're actually dealing with a fairly serious form of constitutional review and oversight. So far, it seems so good. The first of the two particular questions that one then worried about in this particular case is whether or not the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions conditions can be avoided simply by refusing to issue the permit. Now, on this issue, Justice Alito writing for the five-member majority and Justice Kagan writing for the four-member dissent, conservative and liberal as usual, both were in agreement that the verbal formulations were not sufficient unto the day to get you out from underneath this particular doctrine. In other words, it would be absolutely crazy to say that, you know, look, we'll give you the permit, but you have to do X, Y, and Z, as opposed to saying, we won't give you the permit unless you do X, Y, and Z, and to subject them to completely different constitutional regimes. So at this particular point, formalism takes a back seat in the United States Supreme Court by all nine justices, and it's quite clear that the doctrine is now going to be into play. On the second question, however, there was a division of opinion. Justice Alito took the view that it did not make a difference whether you were talking about the in-kind exactions that were required with respect to the particular building site, or whether or not you wanted people to spend money in order to fix culverts and drainage ditches somewhere else inside the project. He said whether it's cash or whether it's kind, it's still an exaction. And if you announce that you can always do the cash settlement and never do the in-kind settlement, what would happen is all the in-kind exactions would disappear, and what governments would do would then ask for huge sums of money to be spent elsewhere for common public improvements, or the permit is denied, and then in effect what would happen is there would be no relief. So he took the position, and I think he quite rightly took the position, that this is not to be satisfactory. In dissent, Justice Kagan came back and said, look, if we do this, then it's going to be impossible to distinguish the special exactions that arise in a case like this from ordinary real estate taxes and fees of one kind or another that everybody agrees to be sort of routinely and per se constitutional. Now, the problem with her, I think, takes place on two dimensions. In the first place, I think it's perfectly clear that this particular exaction bears no relationship to any kind of real estate tax, for example, which is based upon the value of the property. It's also clear, if you look at the distribution of benefits and burdens, all of the burdens are going to fall upon this fellow to repair those culverts far away from his own home, but he doesn't get any greater benefit from them than any other citizen inside the community. So this then leads to the second point, which is why would we say, even if we were to call this thing a tax, that it should be immune from constitutional scrutiny when it forces one individual to bear all the burdens for something which is clearly a widely distributed public benefit. There's a long tradition in our takings law dating back to Armstrong against the United States, which says that the whole purpose of the takings clause is to make sure that single exactions on individuals are not going to be used to fund projects which belong to the public as a whole. So in that case, they said you can't require the owner of a ship lien to essentially lose it so that the boat can be repaired for the benefit of everybody else in the United States. So I think, in fact, she is wrong on both of these two points. What is left over in this particular case is what next? And in dealing with this particular issue, our friend Justice Alito takes a surprisingly different point of view. His basic attitude throughout the entire position is, we don't have to get to the remedy question now. We're just worried about the issue of whether or not this doctrine of unconstitutional conditions applies. And it seems to me that that has to be regarded as something of a mistake. This case has been going on for well over a decade to begin with, and now you're going to send it back to the tender mercies of the Florida court, which is going to have to decide which kind of remedy it's going to give and why. In my view, whenever you're dealing with something that involves the takings clause, it's as much a constitutional duty to specify the particular remedy as it is to specify that certain kinds of conduct is a violation of the basic underlying rights. And at this particular point, it's not all that difficult to do. At the very least, our friend Coons has lost the development rights associated with this property for a good number of years, which surely is worth something in terms of its foregone income or pleasure, and he's got the prospect of many more years. If it turned out that the local folks knew from the beginning that they were under an obligation to provide some degree of compensation the moment they decided to engage in these interminable delays associated with these intolerable conditions, their behavior would differ really very radically. Because if you're trying to get the government to make an honest appraisal of how much value it attaches to the wetland around Coons' property, the simple and correct way to do that is to forget about all this jazz associated with so-called environmental mitigation and to do it the plain old-fashioned way. let the government condemn out of public monies as much or as little of Mr. Koontz's lands as it wants, paying fair market value for whatever project it did. If you put it in that particular fashion and put this thing on budget in the hands of the state, I guarantee you that the hundreds of thousands of dollars of lost revenue to Koontz and the lost tax revenues to the government would never justify a public appropriation in order to condemn that particular wetland. And that's what the eminent domain clause is really about. It's to make sure that if you want to have specific exactions against specific individuals, you show that they've done some kind of specific wrong or are receiving some kind of specific benefit. Or otherwise, what you do under these circumstances is either you let them develop in the ordinary course subject to the usual rules against polluting public waters and the like, or in fact condemn them out for fair market value. So what we do is we certainly have progress in the right direction in this case, but we have a good ways to go before we get a complete and comprehensive analysis of what the takings law and the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions should apply to cases of this particular sort. This is Richard Epstein of NYU Law School, the Hoover Institution, and the University of Chicago, thanking you for listening to this podcast for the Federalist Society.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.